So thanks for asking me to come here, and it's very nice traveling out here, really nice commute. It should be free form because I sort of threw a whole bunch of stuff together. There's no way I'm going to cover it all, I think, but I wanted to hit on some themes. And some of the stuff, I must say, a bunch of these topics I loaded in the last half hour, so we'll see how this goes. So in keeping with this sentiment of having it be free form. So I want to talk today about the fact that this thing doesn't work at all. Okay, I'm going to do this manually then. I'm going to talk about regulatory networks, gene regulatory networks, and other processes that are involved in specification of cell fates during embryogenesis in C. elegans. And if I have time, although I don't know if we'll get to this, I'll talk about the beginnings of our work in understanding how cell fates can be unspecified and reprogrammed into new cell identities. So what are the mechanisms that control that? But I'd like to spend most of my time on the specification mechanisms in the early embryo. And there's a bunch of themes I'm going to try to cover during this talk, and I'll probably cut some out along the way. First of all, we're going to look at a series of events that sequentially subdivide cell fate, starting from multipotential precursors and sequentially constrained developmental trajectories to more specific fates. And we're going to see in at least the system we're looking at that cell division appears very important in that sequential subdivision, both built into the C. elegans lineage and in looking at our gene regulatory network, it seems to be tied to cell division program. So we can talk about that a bit. We're going to see that a lot of the regulatory factors that we've been looking at in specification of the early embryo are highly redundant, and that redundancy has been preserved over large evolutionary spans. So maybe we'll have something to say about, or there may be some questions along these lines, about developmental robustness in the system. If I have time, I'll talk about how a single regulatory factor can have two very, very different outputs, particularly at the stage at which cells undergo what we call an asymmetric cell division. That is, a cell is born to produce two different daughter cells. A single regulator can have quite different effects on those two different daughters, and we'll take that on a bit. And I probably won't have time to talk about what we've looked at in terms of modulation of signaling systems, but I will, I think, try to talk a little bit about what are the mechanisms that drive differentiation in one direction, this forward-driven process, and address whether that can be reversed at all. Over the course of these subjects, I want to bring in the notion that these regulatory networks that we're looking at certainly have an aspect of evolutionary conservation for sure, but that in fact processes that I would have thought of as being very distinct and not easily changeable show a tremendous amount of plasticity. So we're going to see cases where there's remarkable plasticity in quite different developmental modes between relatively closely related species or somewhat related species. Okay, so let me introduce the concept of specification and differentiation by focusing in particular on germ layers. And this already is going to address a kind of an evolutionary issue in terms of plasticity. So germ layers, classically defined germ layers, are really the products of evolution that distinguish various steps in evolution from each other. So, of course, I think you've probably discussed these kinds of evolutionary trees. And so coanoflagellates, which are...
We never went back this far.
Never went back to coanoflagellates, okay.
We did this split between
your just up here.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so this is sort of our whole, this is the whole tree, we think, very simplified way that we think of for metazoan evolution. The sister group of the metazoans is believed to be represented, a surviving relative of that is represented by the coanoflagellates. These are single-cell organisms that are the closest relatives to the multicellular creatures. So something that gave rise to coanoflagellates was also thought to undergo a change that allowed it to be multicellular, allowing for creatures that perhaps gave off something like modern-day sponges. Sponges do not have any discernible layers. They have a lot of differentiated cell types. They don't have specialized organs. They don't have layers of cells that distinguish during the formation of an embryo, that distinguish broad tissue territories from one another. And then at some point in this evolutionary tree, it's believed that there were two germ layers, two layers of cells that were invented, that were innovated to create a double layer, although this is still somewhat controversial, double layer type embryo. We now talk of diploblasts, modern day diploblasts, which have two discernible layers as being descendants from that. But that's pretty controversial. Yes?
Well, the hydra on this tree.
The hydra would be in the diploblasts. Okay, so these are the cnidarians and the ctenophores, which the modern-day diploblasts may not even be diploblasts. There's good evidence, in fact, that they may have three germ layers. So, in fact, this whole thing may fall down. But certainly there are good arguments, at least, that there were two layers, an outermost and an innermost layer, that were invented initially. And then a third layer came along after the diploblasts, the mesoderm, which gives rise to muscle and other organ types, to produce, I guess, what has been the focus of most of the talks here, the triploblasts. And we have, on the one hand, the deuterostomes, which, of course, we're a member of, the chordate phylum, and the protostomes, which include two clades, the Lophotrochozoa and the Ecdysozoa. And you've discussed those groups, I think. And in the Ecdysozoa are nematodes, fruit flies that you've heard a lot about, and a lot of other critters.
Do you have to put the flatworms?
Flatworms are Lophotrochozoa, although they're really polyphyletic, so it's there are some flatworms that don't fit in there, and I don't know where they go, actually, but most flatworms are... Sorry? Well, that's where they're considered, but I think there's not enough molecular information to really make a strong conclusion. That's my understanding. Acyl flatworms, yeah. Yeah, they're often considered sort of where, though? I mean, they have mesoderm, so another branch, for example, could be the acyl flatworms. But planaria, for example, are certainly in the Lophotrochozoa. Okay, so the invention of germ layers are very important transitions evolutionarily. If this chart is right, then it would also imply that the ancient invention of these germ layers, these three germ layers, would somehow carry down all the way to modern day creatures. That is, the regulatory toolkit that specifies the identity of these germ layers may have been carried down through all of these guys. And I think the evidence we have to date seems to suggest that's the case. So germ layers, this is a slide I stole from my colleague Bill Smith. Germ layers are very evident in vertebrates. You can see very clearly in Xenopus, for example. You can fate map the early embryo into the ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm, three germ layers that give rise to different cell types. For example, the ectoderm giving rise to the skin and the nervous system. Mesoderm, skeleton, muscle, and other organ types. Endoderm, the innermost of the three germ layers, giving rise to the gut, pancreas, lungs, and other structures. And during gastrulation, these become concentric layers, ectoderm on the outside, endoderm on the inside. And so I've argued that the regulatory machinery that specifies the identity of these germ layers has been was invented a long time ago and carried down in all the animals that we think of as triploblasts. And if that's true, then in fact that regulatory toolkit may even be used in organisms in which you don't see distinct germ layers when the types of precursor cells that are established in these various identities are first established. So what I mean by this is, if we look at our little critter C. elegans, you've probably seen that slide a bunch of times, and I won't go through all the advantages of C. elegans, actually, but if we look at C. elegans, in C. elegans, okay, I'm going to come back to this point. In C. elegans, the germ there aren't really discernible germ layers, and I'm going to account for that in a minute. The specification events that dictate endoderm, mesoderm, and ectoderm, which I think we can still speak of, occur so early that there are not these three clear germ layers established. But I want to account for that a little bit in a minute. So let me just review what we know about C. elegans development. So this is really the most completely described organism on the planet, I believe, in terms of its development and anatomy. And I think Marianne described the attributes of this creature a bit already. So this is the entire cell lineage of the animal, worked out by John Sulston, Judith Kimball, Bob Horvitz, and some other people. And basically, we have a fate map of every single cell going from fertilization to the 959-cell adult. So we know where every cell comes from and where what every cell will become. And as Marianne said, the lineage is quite reproducible from animal to animal. There's not very much variation. In fact, in my lab, we discovered a surprising variation that hadn't been known about in formation of the male mating structure, and she talked about some other variation. But for the most part, the lineage is quite reproducible. And that lineage has been mapped onto the entirety of the anatomy. So we have a complete wiring diagram of the nervous system. The entire anatomy has been linked to this lineage. The main part of development occurs very rapidly in this creature. In the fertilized egg, things go like gangbusters in the first 6 hours. So most of these divisions, this is all embryogenesis. And the time scale here, this is only about 6 hours up to about this point here. And what you can see is that nearly all of the divisions are occurring very, very quickly in this animal to create hatching out of this eggshell, a larval worm that has essentially the body plan of an adult. It's sexually immature, but it has the whole body plan laid out. So this is really where things are happening during development, the most extreme amount of development going on in embryogenesis. Yes? There should be probably 1,090. There should be 1,090 tips because 131 cells undergo cell death. Yeah, every single cell should be represented in this diagram. There should be 1,090 little tips there. Yes. Yeah. There's no brief. That's right. Yep. So it's 1,090 because 131 cells undergo programmed cell death. Okay. And we just stop drawing the lineage as soon as the cell is born and does its thing. Okay. When this lineage was looked at, in fact, over 100 years ago, it was recognized initially that there were certain cells that were established early in the embryo that set up whole tissue territories or whole tissue types. And since that, we've become familiar with the fact that in the early development, there are a series of cell divisions, asynchronous cell divisions, that give rise to the six founder cells, as they're called. And the definition of a founder cell is a cell that, once it's born, gives rise to essentially a clone of cells in as much as all its descendants divide with the same cell cycle periodicity. So all the descendants of each of AB divide with a certain cell cycle periodicity. All the descendants of MS divide with a different cell cycle periodicity, but they all divide in synchrony with one another. That synchrony breaks down later on in development, but at least through the first several rounds of cell division, each lineage has its own cell cycle clock locked in. As well, each of these founder cells gives rise to different sets of cell types. For example, most of the ectoderm arises from AB. We sort of think of that as the major ectoblast. My lab had shown many years ago that AB, when it's isolated, even though AB does produce what could be considered some mesoderm, this is the muscle of the pharynx, in isolation, if AB doesn't receive any regulatory information, any cell-cell interactions from other cells, it just produces ectoderm. So that's sort of like the ground state we can think of for AB. MS produces most of the mesoderm of the animal. We think of this as the mesodermal precursor, although mesoderm is scattered through the other lineages. Muscle, for example, is made in these other lineages. But we think of this as sort of the mesodermal precursor. And this is definitely the endodermal precursor. So the E cell produces nothing but endoderm. It produces the entire gut of the animal. So we can sort of think of the three germ layers as breaking down to these three founder cells, ectoderm, mesoderm, and endoderm. And you can't push that too far because, for example, by inductions, by cell-cell interactions, AB produces mesoderm. And these cells also give rise to some ectoderm and mesoderm as well. Yes?
How about the MS cell? So
is it true
without signal
before? It's not true. In fact, MS probably makes neurons. It hasn't been looked at closely, but MS does make some neurons, in fact, and that is probably intrinsic to the MS cell. So you really can't think of these as clear homologs of germ layer precursors in a way. But in fact, you can't do that with germ layer specification either, because, for example, the ectoderm gives rise to mesoderm from the neural crest, for example. Cartilage arises from neural crest, and there are many other places where this notion that germ layers are totally locked to specific differentiated cell types and not others just breaks down in all organisms. Okay, but we can still think of these as sort of being major groupings of classes of cells with some other stuff going on there.
So the classification you talked about on the first slide is based on the adult cell types that are there? Is that?
Yeah. Okay? Well, yeah, the embryonic cell types as well. There's
a sort of embryonic invagination or
something right.
Like that.
Okay, so the endoderm and the mesoderm do undergo gastrulation. So you can still, the cells do end up after, these end up in the innermost layer, if you can consider two cells a layer. And these guys end up sort of between that, but it just doesn't have the same striking pattern that you see in a frog, for example. And the reason for that is that the whole process has been telescoped down into events that are occurring when there are very few cells. So the establishment of these cell types, and you can see that right here, these two precursors of endoderm and mesoderm are born at the six cell stage when there's only six cells. And yet, so certainly the endoderm, it gives rise to nothing but endoderm. So you're not going to have the same sort of striking pattern of concentric layers produced. But that's true for C. elegans. That is not a nematode-wide behavior. And I'm going to, in fact, maybe I'll jump to that right now. Let me just show you the lineages of these guys just to emphasize a point I want to make. So if we just look at the endoderm and mesoderm precursors, for example, E and MS, E gives rise to a very simple set of cells, clone of cells, the 20 cells of the intestine. And so it's a simple lineage pattern, and it's the only cell that gives rise to intestine, and that's all it gives rise to. So it's a very simple lineage. Its sister does a radically different thing. By the way, so in the endoderm pathway, we have, in fact, in this whole endomesoderm pathway or mesendoderm pathway, we have regulators that act at a bunch of tiers, and I'm going to talk about that. But in this entire pathway, we have genes that act at 1, 2, and so forth, 4, and so forth, stages all the way through the endoderm lineage. The E cell produces a simple cell lineage pattern. Its sister, MS, gives rise to a very different cell lineage pattern, completely different, much more complex. There's programmed cell deaths, there's more divisions, there's a much broader range of differentiated cell types produced. One of the things we've dealt with is how do these two cells become different from one another if they're born from a common parent. And if I have time, I'll talk about that. We have identified a single regulator that specifies both of these cells, and that regulator acts in combination with what is really a generic switch that tells daughter cells born from an asymmetric division to be different from one another. So I'll try to talk about that if I have time. This cell C, I just introduced this because, in fact, this cell appears by many criteria to be the default state for these cells if they're not properly specified. So this is a cousin of these guys. They have a common grandparent. And C produces skin, so that's an ectodermal cell type, and muscle, this is a mesodermal cell type. And it gives a completely different lineage pattern from these guys, so it's quite distinct from those. Okay, so let me get back to this issue of germ layers, and then I'll talk about the regulatory mechanisms that control the identity of those cell types. So first of all, I argue that that C. elegans are triploblasts, certainly based on molecular evidence. They are triploblasts, fully well in the ecdysozoa. And I argue that, in fact, germ layer specification, the mechanisms for specification, need not be tied to the creation of large layers that are involuting and establishing concentric germ layers. And I believe that's true, and in fact, there's a very nice result that I think drove this home for us. So people always mocked us for calling this process gastrulation in C. elegans. When the E cell is divided to two cells, these two cells move into the interior. They slide into the interior. If you accept that two cells are a layer, that's the germ layer of the endoderm going in. And then they divide to four cells, and now you have these cells internalized. And that is completely uncharacteristic for a protostome. That doesn't, in fact, a lot of people say that's not gastrulation. How can you call that gastrulation? But in fact, Einhard Schoenberg saved the day for us a bit because he identified this species of nematode called Tubrillus diversipapillatus. This is a freshwater nematode that undergoes a very strikingly different pattern of gastrulation than this guy. So instead of the endoderm being born on the ventral, so here's the front of the embryo, this is the anterior and the posterior, here's the ventral side. Instead of being born in the posterior ventral side as two cells and making this solid ball of cells like C. elegans, in fact, this guy makes a hollow ball of cells, and so you get a hollow a blastula like you do with many other species. For example, this is a deuterostome. This is an echinoderm, lidocinus. And you actually get a hollow blastocele produced that continues to divide. And Einhard found that, in fact, you see a layer of cells at the 64, still not a lot of cells, but at least the 64 cell stage. Gastrulation occurs with more cells than we have in C. elegans. And it looks like it involves an involution of cells at the anterior, just like a normal protostome moving into the interior and establishing, I don't really have a picture of this, but establishing a nice gut tube, and the endoderm seems to go in first, and then the mesoderm follows, and that really looks like a protostome pattern of development. So this mockery that's been made of C. elegans simply reflects the fact that C. elegans has just telescoped everything back so far that the specification mechanisms and the rearrangements of cells occur really early, before you can even have layers. And so we think of this as the ancient condition for the nematodes, although certainly there need to be more examples of this. And this is a highly derived condition that was established because this animal develops in such a rapid period of time. This guy develops much more slowly. And so there had to be two events. One would be the movement of the involution process from the anterior over to the ventral side here, and also a heterochronic event, a timing change, so that the specification and rearrangements occur much earlier at only the 28 cell stage. Yes? I don't know if cell counts have been done. I believe this nematode is bigger, so I think the answer is yes, but I don't know about cell counts that have been done in this creature. It's certainly slower developing. I suspect it has a lot more cells, but I don't know the numbers. I'm not sure that's been looked at. In fact, this thing, as far as I know, hasn't been propagated in the lab. It was just isolated from fresh water near UC Riverside, I think. Okay, so what that one of the things that tells us, that's, I'm going to introduce another example also from Einhard's work, that shows us that these dramatically different patterns of cell rearrangement can occur relatively rapidly in evolution. These are both terrestrial nematodes. They're separated perhaps by many, 250 million years, a long time. But nonetheless, within a single phylum, the nematodes, you can get dramatically different methods for establishing germ layers and for undergoing gastrulation. The one that we think of is the classic one, and then these highly derived conditions. And there's lots of examples of that in C. elegans. Okay, so let me go through the regulatory pathway that we've identified that controls the identity of these cells and tell you some of the aspects of it that are of interest in terms of the structure of networks and also of evolutionary interest. Okay, so we actually have a pathway that involves a series of transcription factors starting from early maternal factors that are deposited in the oocyte at the time of oogenesis and proceeding through a cascade of regulators ultimately to the final target protein genes that are turned on in a differentiated gut, the enzymes that are made in a gut. And we have direct links all the way down from these maternal factors all the way down to those differentiated factors. And so I want to run through sort of the skeleton of that and then show you that there's more complexity in here. So the process starts with a transcription factor that is provided maternally. Actually, the RNA is provided maternally. It's called SCN1, identified by Bruce Bowerman many years ago. And SCN1 maternally provides the information to specify EMS, so E and MS. All right. And SCN1, the immediate targets of SCN1, maternal targets of SCN1, are a pair of transcription factors identified in my lab by Morris Maduro called MED1 and 2 for mesendoderm determining genes 1 and 2. So this represents the immediate maternal to zygotic transfer. This thing is loaded in, the RNA is loaded for this, and then it's translated rapidly early in development in the oocyte, and then these guys are the earliest genes that we know of that are turned on zygotically in this animal at the 4-cell stage. They come on at the 4-cell stage. So the maternal to zygotic handoff begins very early in this animal, consistent with everything being telescoped down. Okay, so these guys are essential to specify both of these cell types. They actually control totally different patterns of development, and I'm going to account for that if we have time, the differential output of the meds on E and MS development. If we look at mutants that lack MED1 and 2, we can do this by RNAi. We actually also have double knockouts. What we see is that EM and MS are not made. You don't get any gut. You don't get any mesoderm. And instead, these two cells become C cells. So basically, this transformation looks like it involves a cell lineage transformation and the transformation in cell type. These cells really make the suite of cells that C normally makes. Okay. Now, let's see, did I slip that in here yet? I'm going to come back to that. I'm going to come back to one curious point. So you're going to see a lot of redundancy in this pathway. These guys are 98% identical. They're on two chromosomes, two different chromosomes. They're 98% identical. You knock out one, you get no phenotype. You knock out the other, you get no phenotype. You got to knock out both of them. And you're going to see that's a theme that pervades this whole regulatory network. There's a lot of redundancy built in here. We assume to create robustness against all the environmental changes that the animal deals with in nature. And so we can talk more about that in a few minutes. But let me continue through this regulatory network. These guys, once they have specified E and MS, they do so. So let's just focus the E branch. Now we're going to ignore the MS branch for a minute. Their immediate targets are a pair of transcription factors called END1 and 3. And I should say that both of these guys are redundant got to type transcription factors. These are zinc finger transcription factors that recognize GATA in their target sites. These guys are perfectly good GATA factors. These guys look like GATA factors. They are not GATA factors in terms of their recognition sequence, and I'm going to come back to that. That allowed us to identify more of the network. They actually recognize a modified GATA type sequence. So in the E lineage, these guys turn on end 1 and 3 that are involved in specifying E development. If we eliminate end 1 and 3, then actually we have defects in gastrulation, and we fail to repress C-fate. That is, we don't make E-fate, and C-fate comes on. And you can see that actually in cell lineage patterns, for example. This is an old result. But here is the normal E lineage, part of the normal E lineage. And here is the E lineage when we delete these two genes, which are, again, redundant with one another. We see the E lineage turns into a C lineage. It looks just like a C lineage. So there's a clear E to C transformation. And this is a pretty specific effect. We can get a pretty good worm that just lacks gut, just lacks endoderm. And all the cells that would have been endoderm are becoming C-type fates. They're becoming skin and so forth. Okay, these guys are very robust activators of endoderm. They can activate endoderm anywhere we express them at a specific time in development. So either end 1 or 3 are sufficient to convert a C. elegans embryo that has an endoderm, 20 cells of the endoderm and lots of other cells, into a C. elegans intestine. So these guys are embryos in which we've forced expression of either of these factors over the entire embryo using a heat shock construct. And every cell in the embryo has become endoderm. And all other pathways of development are shut off. Now, that transformation of all other cells into endoderm can occur only over a certain window of time. So cells outside the endoderm lose their competency to respond to the endoderm promoting factors at a certain time in development. And we've been dissecting apart that competency mechanism in the lab. This gets to the issue of how is it that cells convert from a multipotential state to a restricted state. That may reflect simply mechanisms of cell fate restriction in other lineages, or there may be more global processes that are involved in converting a multipotential state into a much more restricted cell type. And we actually have reason to believe that both of those are true. Okay, at the end of this cascade are another pair of redundant GATA factors called ELK2 and 7. These guys are, and I should say all these arrows are, we know these are direct targets in each case. These guys are activated by end 1 and 3. They are required for differentiation of the intestine. So if we delete these guys, we don't get an intestine. It's not made at all. It's not differentiated. But the cell lineage looks to be relatively normal. Okay, and so what this cascade does for us, as I said, is it links maternal factors loaded into the oocyte all the way to the proteins, the structural genes that make up the intestine. So we have a whole cascade really linking this from the earliest maternal stages all the way to differentiated products. Okay, so I want to say some things about this in looking at this. One of the aspects of this is that these regulatory tiers are involved in specification. They sequentially specify through the lineage different cell states. So SKIN1 and the MEDS are specifying EMS and the daughters of them together, ENMS. END1 and 3 specify E specifically. ELK2 and 7 act downstream of END1 and 3. So these guys are all involved in specification. They come on for a short period of time and then they go off again. And their goal really is to just get this set of transcription factors on. These guys maintain their own expression. There's an autoregulatory loop, crosstalk between these two guys, and autoregulation on each of their promoters. And that is a lockdown switch. That lockdown switch, once set, maintains the differentiated state of the intestine, and all of the intestinal genes that are maintained throughout the rest of development are held into place with this lockdown switch. So these guys stay on through the rest of development. So we have a conceptual transition from specification to differentiation.
In the adult cell, you suppress this here.
If you suppress this in the adult, you get a gut that starts to sort of fall apart. It's just probably a lot of normal gene expression in the intestine just sort of fades off, and that's not going to sustain the organ. So they sort of degrade. Okay. Yes.
So you said the first three,
and it's very short, yeah.
Is timing controlled by degradation of maternal SKN1 RNA? or there are other mechanisms?
Okay, so that's a very important question. We don't know exactly what the timing control is about, but we do know that this messenger RNA does fade off and the protein fades off. It fades off, in fact, this is a very simplified view. So skin one probably acts on these guys. The meds may act on these guys, so they're jumping over their intermediaries, and that's seen a lot in regulatory pathways. I think I have a slide that shows that more, that there are that these guys are acting at different stages. But these guys are fading away. They certainly don't stay on. Each of these tiers comes on and then goes off pretty shortly after it goes on. So we don't know what the shutoff is, but it could be. It's pretty sufficient to say that as skin one fades away. We haven't looked at it quantitatively enough, but it looks like the med transcripts are fading off shortly after skin one goes away. So if you simply just say the proteins and the RNAs are unstable, that will set, I think, the appropriate timing with these guys. Okay? Yeah?
So skin one is different than med 1-2. Med is different than N1-3.
Yes.
Well, what's the logical difference between N1-3 and L2 and 7? Why can't you just short circuit and go from N13 into the adult E3?
Right. So part of the reason for that is N1 and 3 are involved in repressing C-fate, perhaps directly. These guys actually prevent C genes from coming on. These guys don't show that effect. If you get rid of these, C-fate doesn't come on. Okay. So that's one thing. Let me just say I can justify sort of each one of these. We go to here. Each one of these tiers seems to have a reason to exist. So I think that'll cover your question. Okay, so let me just go through the whole thing. So the various features of this are, first of all, there's a huge amount of redundancy. Okay, I'm going to come back to that point in a minute. There's redundancy here, here, and here. In fact, the inputs that get these guys turned on are also redundant. There's a lot of redundancy in the system. The cell division program, although this hasn't been causally linked yet, but the cell division program seems to be involved in segregating these tiers. It's hard to dissociate this because, in fact, these events, these cell divisions are occurring very quickly. But each regulatory tier comes on after a round of cell division from the previous tier. So these guys line up pretty well with the cell lineage. Okay, but to get back to your question, each of these tiers, we can justify the existence of each of these. Skin one turns on the meds, and it has other outputs. It turns on a factor in the EMS lineage that's involved in inducing mesoderm in the AB lineage. Okay, and the meds don't have that role. The meds have these two outputs, so there's an obvious reason. The meds turn on another set of transcription factors here that I'll talk about. It makes sense there's a split there. These guys regulate the cell division rate in the E lineage. They regulate, as I said, repression of C development, and they regulate gastrulation. These guys do not do that. And they, you know, it makes sense. You need to regulate gastrulation at a very specific time in development. You need to change the cell cycle at a very specific time in development. You need a tier at that point to be able to do that. These guys are just sort of stupidly involved in maintaining the state of the intestine. Okay.
So overexpression ELT2 or 7 does not switch the fate as well as...
It does, yeah, they can switch the fate, but they don't do it as well. That's right. Yeah, now the fact that they can means this is overexpression, so in fact they may access some of the same targets that these guys do. When they're overexpressed, they're really overexpressed, so they may be able to hit those C targets, for example, at very high levels and repress C development. Nope, they don't do either. They do not touch MS fate, actually. So if you get rid of the ends, you do not see MS fate coming up here. And the reason for that is, I'm going to get to that. There's actually a generic switch that's involved in controlling the output of the meds so that they either turn on MS fate or E fate. There's an extra switch involved in this.
I'm trying to understand the meaning of the two arrows.
These two arrows?
Yeah.
The meds turn on the end genes in the E lineage. And they do not turn on the end genes in the MS lineage for reasons that I'm going to describe. There's a combinatorial action of a generic switch that determines their appropriate output. Okay. In the MS lineage, so the meds are acting, they start here, they come on in both of these cells, they turn on endoderm development on the one hand by activating these guys, on the other hand they turn on mesoderm development by acting on another set of targets. And their differential output is something I'll account for in a few minutes. Okay. Okay. I talked about these various aspects of this regulatory tier. We'd love to know if, for example, cell cycle is really causally linked to these switches, and we believe it is. Jim McGee's lab had shown many years ago that if you block DNA replication in the cell cycle here, preceding the establishment of the endoderm, this was before these genes were known, you block endoderm formation. So we're postulating that, in fact, maybe S phase is required at each one of these stages to allow new transcriptional states to be established. We'd like to test that causally. It's an experiment we haven't done yet, but we now have all the genes to look at that. But this issue of redundancy, this gets to a curious evolutionary question. There is a lot of redundancy in this system. As you can see, these guys are redundant, redundant, redundant. These are there to torture geneticists and to make sure you make a worm correctly. And so an extreme case is with the meds. And this gets to the fact that there must be some continuing selection for redundancy, unless you think of some other explanations for this. If we look at the meds, so this is work by Morris Maduro. So a lot of this work I've talked about was done by a postdoc in my lab, Morris Maduro. He has his own lab at UC Riverside now. And in his lab, starting in my lab and then in his lab, he identified the meds in other C. arabiditis species. So here they are in C. elegans. They're 98% identical, and there are a lot of regulatory sites for skin 1, because skin 1 activates expression of the meds. And so those are conserved sites present in both of those guys. If you look at C. briggsi, there are also two med genes, but they're in the same, they're not syntenic with each other, they're on the same chromosome, and they're pointing in different directions here. So there's two there as well, and these guys were separated by 50 to 100 million years, so argued 100 million years. C. ramanii, which is separated, I think, also about 100 million years, is argued. So there's sort of a three, I think these are viewed as three apices of a triangle in terms of their distances from one another. C. ramanii is insane. It has seven med genes. These guys have conserved skin 1 sites, suggesting that they really are responsive to skin 1 input. Morris's lab has shown that five of these seven can substitute for meds in C. elegans embryos. So they are functional in C. elegans. They can activate mesendoderm development in C. elegans. This is an absurd amount of redundancy, sevenfold. There's at least twofold. There seems to be some selection for redundancy. I should say the ends, likewise, are replicated. For example, in C. briggsi, there are three end genes, and they all seem to be involved in endoderm development. Yes?
Is there any evidence that what's going on is selection for redundancy rather than just quantity of the message or classic duplication ones like self-actualization or those?
I mean, it could be quantity of the message, but I mean, I don't understand why you can't just activate one gene a little better, throw in more skin 1 sites or something. It could be that, but the quantity of the message is not essential, at least in this species. If we delete that gene, we see no phenotype. If we delete that gene, we see no phenotype under normal growth conditions.
I mean, lab growth. Loss, so there's no obvious phenotype, but
yeah.
The
sure. Absolutely. We haven't done those kinds of competitions. We haven't thrown, and I'd like to do that actually, we haven't thrown a lot of environmental conditions at these that would reveal maybe under, so going back to Marianne Felix's talk, she showed that the Wnt pathway in vulval development is almost irrelevant in animals grown in the lab. But in fact, if you starve, I think, L2 larvae, then it becomes very important. And the RAS pathway, which is very important under normal growth conditions, becomes less important. So it may well be that under starvation conditions or heat conditions or salt changes or whatever, that these guys become essential. That may be the selective pressure. One thing to say about this, I don't know if this is relevant at all, but all the gonadofactors in vertebrates have two zinc fingers. All of these guys have a single zinc finger. And there is one C. elegans gonadofactor that has two zinc fingers, and it is the only one that isn't redundant. Now, I don't know what that means. You could assume, well, maybe two of these have to come together and make an active zinc finger. But that still doesn't explain why you can get away with just one of them, right? Maybe they multiply. Why would you need two different genes? The other thing to say about this is this expansion has occurred independently in these three lineages. So here, what? Sorry. Yeah, yeah. In the cases that have been looked, Morris hasn't looked at all of these, but he's looked at several of these, and they really do look like they're showing the same expression pattern and function in cross-species experiments. We don't know. I mean, that experiment hasn't been done. By RNAi, I guess you could try to knock them all out. It has not been done.
You said five could substitute, but did you try the other two?
No. We tried five of them. They all substituted, so like...
Maybe two didn't.
Yeah, so maybe there's only five.
Seven, and then...
Yeah, and they do something completely different. But there are skin one sites. This one has a bunch of skin one sites downstream and only one upstream. And there are skin one sites around all of these guys. It doesn't prove anything. And I don't think you look at the expression of all of these. So, yeah, it's possible that not all seven of them are redundant at this level. Yeah?
Does it look like obvious duplications, or have they, I mean, what about the sequence?
Yeah, they look like obvious duplications. So, for example, here are these seven guys, right? And there are various sort of levels of duplication. You can build a tree, but the one point is that this expansion occurred independently in each of these three lineages.
The scale here, so let six remain, let seven remain, so what kind of similarity do they have?
Med 6 and Med 7, I believe they're sort of upward of 80%, but I don't know the exact number. Actually, I'd have to go back to the paper. They're above, yeah, yes. Yeah, there may be, they're very highly conserved at the binding domain level. Yeah. Okay, so this redundancy has expanded out independently in these lineages. And the other curious thing about this, now that may talk about the may speak of the mechanism. None of these guys have introns, which is kind of strange. But and so you might start to think, well, maybe there's some retroposon method of expansion. Maybe these guys are actually there's a some sort of, you know, the transcript is then being reverse transcribed into DNA, and there's expansion that way. But the problem is then you got to also get all those regulatory domains inherited. And for example, with MED1 and MED2, the regulatory domains, I didn't show that, but they're pretty well conserved, the overall architecture. In fact, there's a lot of identity between these two genes in the upstream regulatory region, particularly, of course, in the SCN1 binding sites, but in other regions as well. So it's not a retroposon mechanism. But these guys don't have introns, so I don't know if that's at all related to this or not, but we're certainly struck by this bizarre redundancy. Okay. Let's see. I'll go with this. Okay, let me get into another little bit here. So we have this regulatory cascade. Here it is, sort of summarized, SCN1 meds, ends. I'm going to come back to the MS targets in a little while. One of the questions is, well, why is C the default state? So I hate to hear the word default in development. If a cell is not specified, its default is something else. It's probably not appropriate to think of a default. The ultimate default of any cell is probably not to differentiate at all. And we have a good piece of evidence for that in this case. Okay, so why do these cells become C cells, for example? What is the regulatory network that accounts for the difference between EMS and C, for example? So that's summed up here. P1 gives rise to EMS, and it gives rise, so this posterior cell at the two-cell stage, this is the posterior cell, two-cell stage, divides twice to give EMS, it divides, actually I should have another arrow in there, it divides once to give EMS, and it divides twice to give C, okay, in two different lineages. And all of these cells, all of the cells produced from P1, inherit this maternal factor, SCN1. So SCN1 RNA is present throughout the embryo. It is differentially translated only in the P1 lineage. The other lineage is AB. The other half of the embryo is AB. So it's only translated in the P1 lineage. But all of these cells, all the descendants, produce SCN1. So SCN1 is required to get the meds on in EMS, and so it makes sense that EMS has SCN1. SCN1 is also present in the C lineage, but C doesn't turn the meds on, and it doesn't turn into ENMS. As well, all of these descendants express another transcription factor called PAL1. This is a caudal homeodomain type transcription factor. And it is also differentially translated in the P1 lineage. It's present in all of these guys. PAL1's function, as shown by Craig Hunter a number of years ago, is to turn on C development. So it's essential for C development. SCN1 is essential for EMS development. Both cells have both transcription factors. How do you explain their differential output? So the way we understand this, we think, is so the SCN1 can turn on the meds if there's no other information blocking it. So in the EMS lineage, it's turning on the meds. And the meds, not directly, but probably their downstream targets, probably at this level, because I already argued for the ends doing this, somehow prevent PAL1 from gaining access to the C gene. So these guys, we presume, are direct repressors of C target genes. And they keep C development off. So what that means is if you get rid of any part of this pathway at all, then these cells are going to allow PAL1 to turn on C development. And that's why we get this transition from ERMS into C development. And in fact, the C development you get in these guys is completely dependent on PAL1. If you get rid of it, you don't get C. You just get kind of nothing. I should say, when you get rid of PAL1 in normal embryos, C really doesn't do anything that we can tell. It just divides a bunch of times and makes a bunch of nothing-looking cells. They don't seem to switch. So you can think of that as being a true default. They don't switch into any particular pattern of development. They just look undifferentiated. So if there is a default or a ground state, it's just not to differentiate at all. In the C lineage, SCN1 and PAL1 are both present. Why doesn't the same thing happen over here? The reason is, and we don't know the input yet, but GSK3, glycogen synthase kinase 3, a component of Wnt signaling, prevents SCN1 from activating the meds. And Keith Blackwell's lab has shown that GSK3 phosphorylates SCN1 in a different context and inactivates it. So we believe this kinase somehow prevents this guy from being active. It just can't turn on the meds. This is not a Wnt-dependent process. This is a Wnt-independent process. We can't get any Wnts that block that. But if we get rid of GSK3, okay, so if they're preventing SCN1 from turning on the meds, then it's basically like turning off this system over in the C lineage. PAL1's going to turn on the C gene. If we get rid of GSK3 and nothing else, what happens? SCN1 activates the meds in the C lineage. That's sufficient. And then C turns into EMS. Okay, so it's that GSK3 that controls this switch between these two outputs. Both cells have the same sets of transcription factors. GSK3 controls the output. We don't know what the input into that is, but this opens up the possibility of, at least I'm throwing out a hypothesis, of a possible evolutionary interpretation of what might be going on here. Let me just make a postulate for what might be activating this and how this may represent the remnant of perhaps a primordial system for cell-cell communication. We assume there's some input into C that's involved in this process. So far, laser cell ablations and so forth haven't uncovered a signaling cell. But let me show you something that looks a lot like this pathway in a different nematode. Okay, so there's an evolutionary issue. Yeah?
GSK3 is not on in P1.
We don't know if it's active in P1, certainly. It's present there.
Pressing EMS, right? Maybe there's no special input in.
Okay, so that's the other way. There may be an input into this guy. Okay, so my bias going this way just fits in with the evolutionary argument, but I think we could still come up with an argument the other way. It makes it a little more contorted. Let me describe why I'm arguing that it may go this way. Okay, because I think there's information being sent in other nematodes anyway. There's information being sent from here to there to tell this cell not to become that cell. Let me show you that. Okay, so this again is the work of Einhard Schoenberg, who likes to play with all these different nematodes. He's worked on a nematode called Acroboloides nanus, which is, it's not very closely related to Caenorhabditis, but it is a terrestrial nematode, so it's not half a billion years away. You don't know what it's a couple hundred million years, maybe something like that, away from C. elegans. So the remarkable thing about Acroboloides is its development looks very much like C. elegans. Those early founder cells established, the geometry looks very similar. The remarkable thing is, in fact, it undergoes a totally different pattern of development or a totally different mechanism of development from C. elegans. C. elegans has been classically viewed as a mosaic organism, which means if you kill one cell in the embryo, and John Sulston, who got a Nobel Prize for his work on C. elegans, did lots of these kills with a laser. If you kill a cell in the embryo, what happens is you get a larval worm that's missing the descendants of that cell, and that's all. Nobody comes over and takes the place of that. And that is true over and over everywhere you look in C. elegans. It's highly mosaic. Each cell seems to be locked into a certain cell fate and can't switch its fate.
Is that also true? And I don't know if it's possible, but after laser ablation, can you remove the stuff that is left over?
Yeah. Well, what we've done is we've actually pulled cells out of the embryo. So we've used micromanipulator needles. Steve Gendro, a student in my lab many years ago, pulled AB out, for example. Pulled P1. Jim Priest has done a lot of those experiments. So it's not just laser ablation experiments. Yeah, that is an important caveat. In fact, there are a lot of cell-cell interactions that are occurring that are not disruptable by a laser. But they still are kind of showing a mosaic type of development. The cells can't switch wholesale there's not a kind of regulatory compensation where you can get twin embryos, for example. This guy does give that kind of behavior. Did I see another hand go up? Okay, so here's the cool experiment that he did. So all he did was just ablate AB at the two cell stage. AB is the bigger of the two daughters, just like in C. elegans. It looks like C. elegans development has that weird gas relation and everything. And what he gets when he kills AB is this. He gets a nematode coming out of there with a dead AB. The P1 descendant, the other half of the embryo, is completely capable of making an entire nematode, even though it normally doesn't. Okay, so that's huge regulatory compensation that we simply never see in C. elegans. And he's taken this down the line.
Does he get the same thing if he removes the AB cell?
I don't think he ever did it. He just did it by laser ablation. But that's, you know, I mean, you do the removals only if you don't see an effect. He did see an effect, so there's not, I think, a strong reason to do the removal.
But the cell surface of the AB cell might be doing something very important to the regulatory life for the rest of it.
In kind of a strange way. So it's telling the rest of the embryo, when I'm dead, do stuff. No, when it's dead, it's telling it to do stuff that it wouldn't do when it's not dead. Seems kind of weird, right? When you're killing it, you're saying it's instructing the rest of the embryo. I would say more likely, when it's alive, it's sending information to the rest of the embryo not to be like it. Okay?
Is it possible some inhibitory signal is not effective?
Let's go through the rest of this, and then we'll come up with a... Okay, so here are the kills, and he does more of this stuff. Okay, so for example, if you kill EMS, in C. elegans, what happens? You don't get EMS descendants. You get a partial embryo that's made from P2 and AB, and that's it. In Anonus, to kill EMS, C becomes EMS, based on some lineage analysis he did. C switches over to EMS. That's the same transformation I mentioned that we see when you get rid of GSK3. D appears to become C. The evidence isn't very good. He doesn't know about the rest of this. Here's the AB kills. EMS is the thing that's becoming AB based on... Now, this is not extensive lineage analysis, but his preliminary fate map analysis indicates that the EMS cell is becoming AB when he kills AB. Okay, and the C cell is becoming EMS when he kills AB. So EMS is going away, but it's becoming... But C is becoming EMS and so forth. Again, there's that same transformation that I mentioned in C. elegans. Okay, so... He hasn't looked at that. We don't know if they have the right number of cells. My guess would be that there must be some compensatory cell divisions because these larvae look pretty good. I mean, if they were lacking, AB is the bigger of the two cells in the, and in C. elegans, AB produces 60 some odd percent of all the cells. I don't think those larvae could have only 40% of cells, so I bet there is, but he hasn't followed the lineages thoroughly enough. But his model is that there's sort of this anterior to posterior signaling information going on. AB tells EMS not to become AB. If you get rid of AB, EMS is going to become AB. EMS tells C not to become EMS. You get rid of EMS, C becomes EMS, and so forth down the line. He's postulating an anterior to posterior set of information with sort of a hierarchy where the more anterior guys tell the more posterior guys not to be like them. Okay. And more stuff needs to be done on this, but I think this model fits with his data. And so if this is true, then there may be a system in which EMS is signaling to C to tell it not to become EMS. That system may in some way be subsumed into the way C. elegans now controls EMS and C development. Okay, so in Acrobolides nanus, EMS seems to tell C not to be EMS. Perhaps it's doing it by activating GSK3 and turning on this whole system. This is strictly a postulate. We don't have any evidence for this yet, but it'd be fun to tear this down molecularly and see if this model is right. And then what we have is this remarkable plasticity. You can switch from a highly regulative mode of development to a highly mosaic mode of development by locking these switches in, by constraining these switches in certain ways, building in the transcriptional regulatory networks in a way that allows them no longer to be plastic, but nonetheless still dependent on these kinds of signaling sources of information. Okay, so anyway, that's a postulate for what may be going on to get these cells to become different from one another. Okay, anyone want to shoot any of that down? Yeah.
So I'm curious about the GSK3 protein expression pattern. Is it maternal?
Yeah. Not that we know. Actually, you know what? We don't have, the message is maternal. I do not know of any good, I don't think anybody has any good antibody in it, so we don't know where the protein specifically is localized. I will.
So part of what you see here could be a localization phenomenon that just goes along with the asymmetric cell?
Yeah, it could be, but EMS, and so this gets worse, and I didn't want to mention this, but GSK3 is required to get E development to occur in the EMS lineage. So it's not required at this level in the EMS lineage, but, and that appears to be a Wnt-dependent process. I'm going to tell you in a minute that Wnt signaling is responsible for specifying E, and GSK3 is required actually positively in that Wnt signaling system. There's kind of a weird flip around here. So we believe that it's present in both of these cells. Or the partner that activates it, for example. And I'm postulating the partner is some signal that's maybe Wnt independent. We haven't been able to knock out a Wnt that does this, for example. Yeah.
Should it have been the insulin pathway?
I'm sorry?
That insulin
pathway? Insulin. Yeah, sure. Actually, insulin, let's see, it's glycogen synthase kinase is regulated by, ultimately, yeah, the insulin pathway, right? Who knows their physiology, right? It kind of, this stuff's a little blood glucose regulation. Certainly, that's how GSK3 was discovered originally. Is insulin involved in this? I don't know of any insulins that are not expressed in the nervous system. I don't know of any early embryonic insulins, but there's a pile of them. There's, what are there, 45 of them or something, so it's possible. That's an interesting idea. Yeah, insulin in specification mechanisms, that'd be cool. I know of no example of insulin involved in specification. That'd be cool. Okay. All right, so let me get back to this differential output. What? Yeah?
Are the Hox gene involved at any point in this?
I'm sorry?
Are the Hox gene?
Oh, no. The Hox genes act much later in development. They act after all these specification mechanisms. In fact, they largely affect post-embryonic cell division. So they establish post-embryonic territories. The Hox cluster is really degenerate in C. elegans. It's blown apart, but it's still, you know, there's still a remnant of it, and it does control anterior-posterior information. In terms of post-embryonic blast cells, what cells in the larva do? Okay, it really doesn't have, they're expressed in the embryo, but they have no, I don't think they have any effect in the embryo in terms of patterning. Okay, so let's get back to this problem that I talked about. So we're seeing that the meds, okay, so the goal is do all this stuff and get the meds on an EMS and then the thing takes off. So the meds come on in here and specify each of these two cells. How is it that they can have differential outputs? Why are these cells different from one another? And we actually know a lot about that. Some work by a talented graduate student, Bob Goldstein, many years ago, and one of his former graduate students is now a postdoc in my lab. Bob had shown that here's the four-cell embryo, that this cell, P2, the posterior descendant of P1, P2 sends a signal to EMS to polarize it, so that when it divides asymmetrically. It gives rise to two different daughters. That's the definition of an asymmetric cell division. They're different from one another. So he showed that P2 acts over a very short period of time, something like a 6-minute window, to polarize the cell. And the reason I say, and if that signal is received, then the side of EMS that touches P2 will become an E cell. The side that's farther away will not. It'll become an MS cell. And it is polarizing in the sense that if he moves it over to the other side, he switches around the polarity of this. So it's an instructive cue that tells these daughter cells to be different from one another. And the output of that signaling system, now it's known that it's a complex, redundant signaling system. P2 sends three kinds of information to EMS. It uses a Wnt-type signaling pathway. There's also a Src tyrosine kinase pathway. There's also a MAP kinase cascade. All three of those guys you can show genetically are necessary for that signal to be transmitted. If you knock out any one of these, you partially attenuate the induction of endoderm. If you knock out all of them, then you completely eliminate endoderm formation. So there's these three redundant regulatory inputs. And I'll simplify what they do. What they do is they convert a repressor of the end genes, a repressor of endoderm, into an activator of endoderm. So they just toggle this guy. This is a TCF-left type transcription factor. This is the name of transcription factors that are downstream of Wnt signaling cascades. And so what happens is this signal must act locally in one region of this cell so that this this transcription factor, which is present in the nucleus of this cell, becomes converted to an activator after the cell divides. It occurs over a very short window of time. And so the system is that POP1 represses the N genes. When it doesn't receive that signal, it's converted to an activator to collaborate with the meds in response to this signal. So there's now two positive inputs that, instead of repressing this guy, both of them together activate those guys. And then you get endoderm development. So that explains why you have different outputs from this. It's the fact that this side of the cell is closer to the inducing cell. And there's actually a nice output of this, and I wanted to mention this because this system, POP1 acting as a repressor in the anterior cell, as an activator in the posterior cell of some of its targets, seems to be acting reiteratively throughout the entire development of C. elegans. So one way you can see this is when this signal is received, POP1 is found at lower levels in the nucleus of the receiving cell. It's at higher levels in the nucleus of the non-receiving cell. So when it's a repressor, it's at high concentrations. When it's an activator, it's at somewhat lower concentrations. This is not a huge difference, maybe threefold or whatever, but there is a difference. And so you can actually see this. And that event occurs reiteratively throughout the entire development of C. elegans. You have a cell, anytime a cell divides anterior-posterior, its daughters are different from one another, virtually always when you look at the lineage, and the amount of POP1 in each of the two daughters is different. High in the anterior, low in the posterior, and that occurs over and over. A high gives rise to a high and a low gives rise to a high and a low. That occurs over and over and over on all anterior-posterior divisions, starting from this stage, not earlier, but this stage, all the way through to adulthood, as far as we can tell. And this recursive switching, this was shown many years ago by Rayling Lin, this recursive switching from a high to a low cell is associated with differences in these cells. So POP1 is required over and over and over to make these daughter cells different from one another. It acts reiteratively to make these cells different. In a generic way, we believe. Yeah, so... Yes. That's right. So beta-catenin is involved in all of these events as well. So if you get rid of beta-catenin, you don't get this differential behavior of POP1, and POP1 acts like this. So beta-catenin is necessary to exclude, partially exclude POP1 from the nucleus. So and beta-catenin is actually nuclear in these cells.
So this differentiation ultimately is Wnt
dependent. Okay, so it's beta-catenin dependent. It's not Wnt dependent once you get it started. Okay, let me show you that, actually. So let me come to that in just a second. Let me just show you what this looks like. It's kind of fun to watch it. Okay, so this is actually a movie Morris Maduro made a number of years ago. He's just expressing this POP1 protein under the control of the med promoter, just to get it isolated to specific cells. And MS has already divided to two cells. Here's a high, here's a low cell. E is divided, a high and a low cell. So even though POP1 has a positive input in E development, after E divides, look, it's differential in the two daughters. And you can just watch this occur over and over, and this is what allowed us. Is that going to work with the lights on? So, yeah, there it is. Okay, let's just look at this high cell, for example. Here's the low, here's the high. When this divides, nucleus is going to break down. POP1's going to fill that cell uniformly, but we believe it's different here from here. Over here, it's going to go into a cell that's kind of excluded from the nucleus. Over here, it's going to concentrate at higher levels in the nucleus. Okay? And that happened as soon as these cells were born. So there's this differential effect. And you can see this over and over. Every time these divide, they're going to do that. So if you see this high cell divide, it's going to give a high and a low. This happens throughout the entirety of the development. That process, we don't have to keep watching. You can take my word for it. There it goes again. It just went again. I lost track of the pairs. Okay, that process occurring reiteratively must be initiated. There has to be sort of initial symmetry breaking mechanism. In the EMS lineage, I showed you what it was. It's this external supply of Wnt signaling. After that, it is beta-catenin dependent. It is Wnt receptor dependent, but it doesn't appear to be Wnt dependent. So it appears to be cell autonomous once you've established an initial break, an initial symmetry break.
I just want to make a comment. This is partially conserved in how Zenicus uses Wnt signaling for axis formation. Because Wnt's signal is required at the very early step in the steps of all cycles, first cleavage and maybe second cleavage. But after that, it goes away. I mean, it's not required after that step. If you just have that initial wind pulse, then the process will take on. And we have shown these by experiments, when you take away wind early, the signal will not be able to establish this pathway after it hits a catena. And if you put it back early enough, you'll be able to rescue it. If you put it slightly later, even high amounts of it, it won't be sufficient to activate the pathway.
But you can take it away completely and you continue to get the output, the
That's true. You can take it away at a later
stage, time, right.
And then you won't get the same effect.
So there's some sort of lockdown occurring on a level of
beta catenin
or upstream of beta catenin. And of course, it's the same GSK kinase that's upstream, acting on beta catenin. So is there some monkey business between those two?
I don't believe GSK3 has been shown to be directly. Beta catenin is definitely involved. I don't think GSK3 has been shown to be involved in this system. In the initial activation by the wind. Right. Right.
Beta catenin is degraded by GSK.
Yeah. Right. That's right.
GSK3 has some other functions that keep doing.
So I suppose if you inhibit GSK, then you'll keep beta catenin active.
Yeah, but that works only at the time cells are being signaled by Wnt. After the thing becomes cell autonomous, GSK3 does not seem to play a role. Beta catenin still plays a role. And so does the Wnt receptor. So actually, Steve?
Is there always a correlation between activity? So when it's high, is it always pressure?
No, in fact, we don't know that. I don't think it is a repressor of endoderm genes here. I think it's an activator of endoderm genes in the low cell and a repressor in the high cell. But I think, in fact, I have evidence that I'll show you, it's acting as an activator in the high cell of other genes, of MS genes, and perhaps a repressor of those genes. And so it's really doing both in both cells. That's what we're thinking is happening. So, but the other targets of, the only targets of POP1 that are really known are the guys I'm talking about in the EMS lineage.
And POP1 is not redundant, right?
Nope. There's just one. Like Romanii, and I don't know. I don't know. I don't, you know? Anybody know? I don't know if they're if it's duplicated in those guys. Why do you ask?
You have some level of redundancy.
Right.
Down at some point.
Yeah. Right. Certainly, it's not at this level. There's not redundancy. So there's redundant inputs into POP1, but it's a bottleneck. There's only a single guy there. Yeah.
Is there any
thoughts or thoughts? Yes, in the EM, I'll show you that in a second. Yeah.
So Michael. You're saying that SARC and MAPK also feed into this.
Right.
Is that into POP1 also?
Yeah, that's part of the event that results in its proper phosphorylation. There's probably a chain of phosphorylation events that cause it to shift into an activator of the N genes and become partially excluded from the nucleus. But that's fuzzy, exactly where the link is. It's based on genetic information. Let me go to this issue of cell autonomy. Let's see. Is this the only thing I have? And that is that the curious thing is that... I have another one coming up. That the Wnt receptor as well shows asymmetric division, it's asymmetric expression. It's high at the posterior levels of a cell before it divides and lower at the anterior side of a cell. And you see, this is work from Jim Preece's lab a year and a half ago or so. And that process is reiterative. That follows the POP1 effect. And Jim's lab showed very nicely that asymmetry, though initially established by a Wnt signaling process, can be maintained in cell autonomously, apparently. So they sequentially isolate AB cells. So they take AB, this is occurring in all the lineages, including AB. They're sequentially separating them apart. And so here's an isolated AB32 cell that's been sequentially separated. The initial asymmetry in the AB lineage where you see this depends on Wnt signaling. After the initial Wnt signaling event, it becomes independent of Wnt signaling, this asymmetry, the POP1 asymmetry and the Wnt receptor asymmetry. And here you can see this is sequentially isolated AB32 cell. It seems to be the contact-free zone where the cells aren't contacting other cells, where you get high that seems to be the polarization cue, at least in these isolated guys. In the embryo, these cells are all packed together, so that can't be sufficient to explain it. But that at least is sort of a default mode for establishing this asymmetry. If you're in contact with other cells, you seem to exclude the receptor, and you drive its expression, its concentration higher in the region that's contact-free. But that's not, I don't think that can explain what's happening in the embryo.
What is the asymmetry we're looking at in the top panels?
Let's see. These are centrosomes. What this is? I don't remember what this is actually. I don't think that's the Wnt receptor. I think that's just marking the outsides of cells, but I can't remember what that panel is. But you do. So in the last slide I showed you, you see over and over this asymmetry on each cell. Okay. So we have this recursive system. It's initially established by a symmetry break dependent on signaling. It then seems to be, by some mechanism, cell autonomously maintained to continually segregate make daughter cells different from one another. I think we're in a position to dissect really the outputs of this at the transcriptional level a lot further when we go back to mesendoderm development. So this system is acting to control the differential output of the meds. Remember, the meds turn on endoderm development here and then mesoderm development here, and they do something quite different in these two cells. So how do they do those different things? Of course, they're acting in conjunction with this POP1 signaling system. And what we wanted to know is, well, okay, what are the targets of these guys so we can dissect apart a whole network and really see the structure of the network and also understand how that switch occurs. So to get to this, what we did, Gina Breitman-Maduro in the lab, just did a simple experiment, just asked where the meds bind to the end-1 targets, end-1 targets, just using a footprinting assay. And what she found is that the meds in vitro bind to a sequence that is duplicated in end-1, that's quadruplicated in end-3, and it's a very specific sequence. This is the sequence. It's very specific, and that sequence is quite different from what we were expecting to get, which was a GATA sequence. Here, remember, this thing is supposed to be a GATA factor. Here's a typical GATA factor binding site with an internal GATA and some flexibility on either side. This site has a very literal sequence that's present, 8 nucleotides that are present in all of these sites, and it's a GATA site. There's an extra T in there. That's thrown in there. So the meds do kind of a weird thing. They don't bind to the DNA the way most GATA factors do. Does that have something to do with the fact there's so many of them? I don't know. Anyway, the neat thing about this is that these genes had multiple copies of that, and that is a sufficiently constrained amount of sequence information that you can, instead of working very hard like Ilya has done to try to find, you know, what are the consensus sequence, what are the flexibilities in the sequence, as he's done to look for sequences that define pan-neuronal gene expression, we can just look directly in a very mindless kind of way for these sequences present in the genome and maybe get something. And in fact, it worked really well. So all we did was take these two sequences, we spaced them apart anywhere from 25 to 100, queried the genome, got a whole bunch of genes that had a lot of these sites in them. Every single one of these are true. They look like our true med target sites. So they are actually transcribed in the mesendoderm lineage. Some of these guys have a heck of a lot of these sites. This guy, this T-box factor, has 8 of these sites. Here's your SOX factor. I'm going to come back to that in a second. So a bunch of transcription factors in these guys. These guys all look like they're direct targets. And the really nice thing about these is these broke down into different classes of gene expression.
I'm sorry, but you're saying there are no other genes which have 2 med sites. Like,
nope.
That's it.
I mean, that's a 16-mer you're looking for, a literal 16-mer. So the odds of a 16-mer are pretty low. Everything we get is right. If you use just exactly that sequence, let's see, not one restriction enzyme is an 8-mer. How many times does it cuts once in the E. coli? No, it cuts, what are the numbers here?
Oh,
every 50 kilos.
A lot of specificity if you look at 2.
Right.
Still curious. I mean, this is
all you've got. That we get no obvious false positives. There's lots of false negatives, I'm sure, because we've constrained this completely. And Morris has actually loosened up this sequence a little bit. He's getting more true targets, actually, I should say. So this is just the first set that we got. But if you keep it that tight, you get all the right stuff. Yeah, so we allowed these to flip around. Okay, so we allowed them to go in either orientation, right? And actually, if we constrain if we put more spacing in there, then we can get more sites as well. But anyway, the main thing is that this validated this very simple approach. Ilya's going to strangle us for this, but because it was so easy. But basically, if we look at these guys, they fall out into three classes of gene expression patterns. We get a set that are expressed in the E lineage, exactly what we'd expect. This is a cell cycle regulator called WEE1. Here's another factor. These guys are E-specific, just like the end genes. We get a set that are MS-specific. That's the first class of MS genes that have been identified. So there's a T-box factor that's essential for MS development, I'll mention in a minute, for example. And an HLH25, this is probably involved in muscle development in the MS lineage. And then here's the SOX factor that's expressed in both of these. So we have two classes of smart genes and a stupid gene. The stupid gene just responds to the meds wherever they are. These guys differentially respond to that POP1 regulated output, activated in E or off in E and activated in MS. Okay, so this really represents a code for us. Now, Boris's lab worked a bit on seeing if we could find sequences between these sets of genes that are specific to this class or this class. There's one potential site, but it really wasn't. Didn't really fall into these classes clearly enough. So we really didn't. And we need to do more informatics on that. I think we really do. We really couldn't figure out what, just by looking at the sequences, staring at the sequences, what this differential output is all about. Okay, so now we have this regulatory cascade. I should say over here, Morris's lab has found, after we found TBX35 in the lab, his lab has now shown that this MS-specific target is required for MS development. If you delete this guy by RNAi, if you delete the gene, then guess what happens to the MS cell? It turns to C. E is intact. So it's the same pathway, so this guy probably represses the C genes over here, prevents PAL1 from acting over here. So this is how this thing is being subdivided out. But in fact, the whole network is more complicated than this, and this is something, I just hate these things, but how many people like these? How many people don't like these? Let me ask that. Yeah. Few, okay. Eric isn't here to give me a hard time about this, Eric Davidson. So this actually was drawn by Morris Maduro in a review he just drew up. And so this is the regulatory network as he's drawn it. You've got to really stare at these things to follow all these pathways. I sort of like looking at it like this because my brain is too small, I think. But this is, you know, there is more information here. And one of the things that we see when we look at this is that there are, this is Eric Davidson's network, there are hints, in fact, pretty strong hints, that at least portions of the network, some of the nodes, are conserved. Not only the regulatory factors, here are some of them, there's actually more going on, but here, for example, there's a FOXA factor downstream and a brachyury or T-box type factor downstream, acting in kind of the same pathway that we're seeing. The GATA factors are linked. This guy is, I believe, upstream of that guy, if you follow it through somewhere. I think there are hints. We need to obviously dissect this apart a lot more. What we want to see is how much of this network do we see in C. elegans and vice versa. And it looks like at least some of the nodes certainly are in common, and some of the relationships between those nodes are preserved. But I don't want to push that point too far yet. We need to look at it more carefully. Also from the mesendoderm network, we see a number of classical patterns that you see in such networks. I think Eric described some of these when he talked about his regulatory network. These are summed up in a review by Morris that just came out. So we see a regulatory chain of the type I told you about. There are feed-forward mechanisms that I described. For example, the meds act. Oh, okay, so one thing I didn't say is that the ends actually do not act exactly in the same tier. N3 looks like it's slightly upstream of End1. End1 does not require End3 for its expression because the meds can turn it on, but also End1 is partially dependent on N3. So there is a sort of a feed-forward motif, and perhaps one of the reasons for the existence of these two factors is to allow for this kind of this sort of relationship. But I will say again, if you delete this guy, for example, you get no phenotype at all. And if you delete that guy, you get a very, very weak phenotype. nonetheless, we see these kinds of motifs at several stages in the network. It's sort of a feed-forward mechanism. Let's see, other ones that I want to, we certainly have autoregulatory motifs acting either directly, where L2, for example, regulates its own expression, or there seems to be autoregulatory loops that are interdependent. L2 and L7 seem to be interdependent on one another. These are, let's see, multi-input motifs as well. So, in fact, this is really like an autoregulatory loop as well. I mean, as a feed-forward motif as well, but just with more components. Actually, we have evidence that it does as well when we overexpress it. So that's only based on overexpression. So we can't activate L7 by overexpressing L7.
We're saying, if I remember correctly in the beginning, that the upstream sequences of these guys have changed. Is that correct?
The upstream
regions of some of these duplications.
Right.
So what are the differences in their regulation?
So the upstream sequences, the meds have changed somewhat. I mean, they all have similar.
For example, but, I mean, the regulation of these.
Right.
You could say the upstream have changed, and maybe some of the way they are regulated has changed.
Right. We haven't seen any clear. So certainly, the upstream regulatory regions of these two guys are quite different. They've diverged a lot. These two proteins have diverged a lot. These are very different from one another. Okay, so and yet they do seem to have cross-regulatory interactions as well as auto-regulatory loops, each of them. So I'm not sure what's the point that you want to make then.
I was just wondering. So I mean, maybe L2 is a wrong example, but we're saying at least about the meds.
Yeah.
That they're almost identical.
Right.
But that their own upstream sequences have changed. Remember
that. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't. I may have misspoken. But in the case of the C. elegans meds, med 1 and 2, their upstream regions are very similar to one another. They're very similar. So the inputs in the meds from skin 1, for example, the skin 1 sites are beautifully conserved, and there's not a lot of deterioration between them. The duplication looks like it was probably pretty recent as well. Okay. So, but they're not. It's not like they're undergoing very different inputs. Those guys seem to be regulated similarly. Oops. One other aspect of looking at sort of the developmental conservation is patterning of the gut, and we don't have a lot of information about this yet. But if we look at, for example, the portions of the digestive tract, we have in these creatures a foregut, a midgut, and a hindgut. The midgut is the endoderm, and in Drosophila we know there's a cascade of regulators. These are gotta factors that specify the midgut. This gotta factor is like the ends. This one would be like the ELTS. So this is the guy that maintains gut differentiation. This is the one that activates the system. The inputs are completely different. The guys that get the endoderm turning genes on are completely different in C. elegans and Drosophila. So the inputs that I described to you, POP1, for example, and SKIN1 and so forth, that's completely divergent. There seems to be kind of a bottleneck here, or a, let's say a phylotypic stage in a way, because we have this cascade as well. There are genes that are involved in development of the hindgut, brachyenteron. We have a gene called MAB9 in C. elegans that's involved in hindgut development. Right now, we're testing whether this regulatory pathway, so this is Jess Porter in the lab, is testing whether this regulation that we see with these two gotta factors inhibiting hindgut gene expression in the midgut is also maintained in C. elegans. We have some preliminary, not a good enough data yet. And as well, both the foregut and the hindgut are activated by forkhead type factors that are regulated through these sorts of regulatory loops as well, and we see similar kinds of things in C. elegans. So certainly the segregation of the gut into various portions also seems to be a process that is conserved, at least across the ecdysoa. Yes?
There are definitely some similarities
right.
With the way these networks are constructed, but in most instances, genes acting in similar
right.
positions in these networks in, say, Drosophila, worms or vertebrates are not orthologous.
Right. That's true.
Families.
Right.
And in some instances, these families are fairly large, 20, 30 genes.
Right.
So I think this has to be taken with a grain of salt that, yes, in fact, there are some similarities. These are not actins and myosins.
Right. So this really proposes a big problem, because when do you decide that a network has been conserved or the nodes have been conserved, or it's just reutilization of a similar set of factors. In fact, they could be independently invented, for example. So, for example, I think if we see this kind of regulatory process, and we're looking at this now, if we get the downstream goddess and the upstream goddess regulating, you know, repressing in the gut the expression of hindgut-specific genes, in particular, for example, this T-box factor, and it's true, these guys are pretty different from one another. Does that constitute the true evolutionary inheritance of an early acquired regulatory module or not? And I don't know where you draw that line. You know, it's mostly a matter of accumulating more and more data, and then at some point you have to make a judgment call.
I agree with you that I don't have an answer.
Yeah.
Right.
You're absolutely right. That's why I really wanted to stress these relationships, because in fact, just the existence of the transcription factors in these tissues means very little. The potential connections between the relationships is hinting, but we're not there yet, I think, hinting at perhaps some kernels, as Eric Davidson would call it, some little modules are carried through. And I think we need more information on that. Okay. I'm running out of time. Let's see, what should I end on? Got one of two things to talk about. What the heck? I could talk more about regulation of Wnt signaling, or I could go on to talk about multipotentiality, switches from multipotential to differentiated states. Or I can, what?
I thought you were giving the vote.
Okay, yeah, okay. The first thing, sort of modulation of Wnt signaling. The second, conversion of a multipotential state to a highly restricted state of differentiation. Who wants to hear A? Who wants me to leave? Who wants to hear B? Okay, I'll do B. Okay. Okay, so this is going to be quick anyway. So basically, this is just a preliminary progress report, but it gets to this issue of competency. What happens during development to cause cells to become, first, starting at a very multipotential state, to become sequentially restricted so that they are not competent to be turned into other cell types? And so we think of, in the embryo, or in stem cell lineages, for example, we think of cells having a tremendous multipotentiality. And for example, stem cells are self-renewing cells. They can maintain this multipotential state. And then something happens in those cells, like mobilization of a gene regulatory network, that causes them to become differentiated and locked into that state. And this is a one-way arrow in general in development. We don't see reversal of differentiation. But we do know that in probably most differentiated cells, maybe except the immune system, certainly the nucleus can be reprogrammed back to the state. That's why cloning works. So we know that the nucleus has all the information to be able to generate a whole animal again. And so the question is, are there true lockdowns acting in embryonic development, and can they be broken? Can we reverse this, for example? One of the hopes would be, you know, we could take differentiated cells and make them undifferentiated again. This could be a way to take mature adult cells and convert them back into stem cells. So that's certainly one applied focus to understanding this. But what we've been asking really is, what's the nature of this conversion step? And is it just, so for example, is the C lineage not able to respond to reprogramming into endoderm at a certain time in development because it's established its own system of gene regulatory network that locks down all of the genes into a positively activated state through positive feedback loops, and they can't be reprogrammed. It's all gene regulatory network control. Or is there something else going on? That was really our question that we were pursuing with this. So we used the system that I described to you before, where we can turn the whole embryo into endoderm, again by expressing either end1 or end3 all over the whole animal. And when we did that, what we found is, in fact, that there is a restricted competency for this reprogramming. We can get embryos that look like this only if we express end1 up through a critical stage. So this is the number of hours after the first cleavage. By 2 hours, the endoderm is established somewhere in this range right here, one to 2 hour range. By 2 hours, certainly by a little after 2 hours, the number of embryos we can convert over by doing heat shock to embryos that are all gut has gotten down to almost nothing. Okay, and after this stage, we can't turn other cells into endoderm. So there's something happening in here that's restricting the multipotentiality. Yes.
Is it happening some cells out of the mind? Is it all or nothing for the rest of the?
We haven't dissected this well enough. My impression is. So as we get into this window, my impression is we see inappropriate endoderm kind of throughout the embryo. There's no obvious positional effect. So I think it's kind of happening roughly at the same time in all lineages. But we haven't dissected that down to, we have to dissect it to minutes to really ask that question. Okay, so, and we haven't done that. But that's a very interesting question. We should look at that. So is there, for example, something that just inhibits, you know, the multipotentiality, or is it just these lockdowns occurring in the other lineage? So the simple approach is just to ask, well, what kind of genes can we interrupt? Can we interrupt genes that then extend this period? Can we make cells multipotential when they wouldn't normally be? Can we extend this competency window? And we can use, I think people have heard about this, we can use RNAi screening techniques, which are well developed in C. elegans. There's whole libraries of the whole genome expressing double-stranded RNAs. You just feed worms on bacteria expressing double-stranded RNAs, and you can get phenotypes, and you know what the gene is that caused the phenotype. So Narek Jabrayan, a graduate student in the lab, has taken this kind of approach to look for extension of that window, and he gets three classes of things plus some other stuff that start to address this question. First of all, he gets a whole set of genes that are transcription factors. They are probably important nodes in gene regulatory networks that act at various stages in development to lock differentiation of other cell types down and prevent those cell types from being reprogrammed. So one of these is a transcription factor called LIN26. LIN26 is required to specify all non-neuronal ectoderm. So it specifies skin and other nervous system that's not neurons. And it was thought, in fact, from Michel Lobwes's work, and he identified that, that the cells that are not properly, if you get rid of this thing, and this thing's acting very late in development, by the way, it's acting much later than these other switches I'm talking about. If you get rid of LIN26, he argued that the cells are becoming neurons. They're switching over to a neural identity. The cells that would be non-neural are becoming neural. But Narek's result indicate that's not the case. Because what he sees, here's a larva, a worm inside the eggshell. And this is an embryo in which he's heat shocked them very late in a LIN26 mutant. And what you can see, here's the normal gut. And right in here, a lot of cells are adopting, or at least expressing, gut-specific gene expression when done late. Normally this wouldn't happen in a LIN26 plus. These would be some of the cells that LIN26 normally specifies. So that certainly says that the cells in the LIN26 minus aren't completely switching from skin into neurons, for example. They're switching from skin to neurons, but confused neurons. Those neurons have not locked down as well, and they can be reprogrammed. Okay, so I'm sorry. So all he does, we just do this experiment, right, way out here. We do the heat shock after a time in which the embryos are no longer capable of activating endoderm development, okay? And we first do RNAi with selected genes from our library. So we've knocked out LIN26, and this has been done with a LIN26 mutant since then. So now we're looking at a LIN26 mutant, and we're doing a heat shock way out here. And we're seeing endoderm coming on at a much later time than it would normally come on ectopically when we force expression of this endoderm promoting factor. Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's right. Okay? And actually, I don't think we're getting a wholesale switch. These guys aren't real gut cells, but they do express other markers. So here's another example. Here's this ectopic gut in one of these late heat-shocked guys, and this is a different marker. So at least a set of markers of gut are coming on inappropriately. At least a portion of the endoderm program is being turned on at a time it normally couldn't possibly be turned on in inappropriate places. So we're arguing that we're extending the window of competency to respond to this factor, or we are making cells multipotential for a longer period of time, okay? Or even with LIN26, which acts very late in development. So in fact, it means that presumably cells have actually become restricted, and then LIN26 carries out part of that restriction, but they can reverse their restriction when LIN26 is eliminated. LIN26 acts pretty late. And so these cells, if you went I think if we did this heat shock earlier in development, we would see this window restriction. We're sort of reopening up the window later on, I believe. We haven't dissected it that carefully, but based on when LIN26 functions.
When LIN26 attacks sooner than previously
postulated. Yeah, I don't think that, I think based on its expression, that's unlikely. No, this is strictly zygotic, yeah. Here's a set of guys that we've gotten. I just want to tell you about the kinds of things we've gotten. I think what it's starting to tell us about the mechanisms that constrain multipotentiality. So here's the wild type in black, again, just showing that window closing off. And here are a bunch of the genes we've gotten of various types, extending that competency window. Here's LIN26 in the pink. Here's a chromatin remodeling factor. This is a histone methyltransferase that also extends that competency window. We haven't pushed this super hard, and this is all RNAi, so we don't know how far we can push that window. But chromatin, not surprisingly, I suppose, chromatin remodeling seems to be necessary to get cells to be locked into their differentiated state, so they will ignore an effort to try to shunt them into another developmental trajectory. And that's the stuff we get. So let me just summarize the kinds of events that we can interrupt to cause this transformation from a multipotential or pluripotential state into a commitment state. Not surprisingly, as we expected, we get transcription factors that are in non-endodermal lineages activating other pathways of development like LIN26, which acts late. ELT1 is a GATA factor that specifies epidermis. PAL1 is this factor that specifies C development. This is a T-box factor that specifies we don't know what yet. All of these guys fit with the notion that the loss of competency to respond to a challenge by another sulfate promoting factor just relates to the lockdowns produced in other gene regulatory networks. These guys all have their own lockdowns. We're just breaking the lockdowns. But there are other things going on in this transition. A bunch of chromatin-related things come out. For example, I described this one. There are other chromatin-related factors that if you mess up the ability to modify chromatin in a certain way, these guys don't seem to block differentiation in general. These embryos go ahead and seem to develop, they're not normal, but they differentiate. But the cells are more confused. They're able to be reprogrammed into other directions. And then one class of things that we're particularly excited about are a set of factors that imply that cell-cell communication is involved in this process. So what I mean by that is that it looks like cells to maintain and lock into a specific differentiated state, for cells to maintain their tissue identity, they may have to remain assembled into a tissue. There is a phenomenon that was described in the late 80s, I believe, by John Gurdon. It's been discussed many times, called a community effect in Xenopus. So in Xenopus embryos, and this community effects have been seen in a lot of other embryos, you can take cells that are muscle progenitors, and they will become muscle if they're together in a clump. If you separate them out so they're not together in a clump, they are not able to turn into muscle. And he calls it a community effect. There has to be a certain number. They're all talking to each other. They're all providing a certain amount of signal. And if that signal goes up to a high enough level, then they're competent to become locked, to become muscle. In this case, what we believe we might be seeing is that, in fact, it's not only that cells are becoming competent to differentiate, but, in fact, to maintain a well-locked differentiated state, they have to continuously talk to each other. Because when we interrupt a number of cell signaling components, which we're able to see cells are able to be transformed at a time when they should be locked in. Yeah?
So would the prediction be that if you would do double mutants or triple, et cetera, that you would get even more extension of this?
That's the hope. That's exactly the hope. So what we're really doing, and I don't have... We haven't even really started. We've been studying cell death regulatory pathways, and we're particularly relying on computational methods to see how protein functions cluster together. We should talk about this a little bit. This is actually based on a whole bunch of database mining techniques. And what we'd like to see is if we can get clustering. I mean, part of it is we can just break these down mentally and say, okay, these are different kinds of things. So what if we knock out one of these and one of those and one of those, for example? Can we reach a state where if we knock out enough components that we can completely make a cell naive? After it's differentiated, postdoc in the lab, Nate Dudley, is trying to get these things to work in larvae, for example, after cells are, not just extend the window, but really take cells that are fully differentiated and reverse them. So if we, that's exactly what we want to do. What are the set of components collectively that we can knock out in the cell to cause it to completely revert its state to a multipotential state? Obviously, if that works well enough, then you could potentially make things like stem cells or progenitor cells out of cheek cells or out of differentiated cell types. That would be the hope. So that's exactly what we'd like to do. Okay.
Sorry. And what about heterochronic mutants? Do they show things that are consistent with it actually being the time?
Yeah. With the competency issue, you mean, or?
Do you see any change in
these? We haven't seen any heterochronic mutants come out of this. All the heterochronic genes that have been studied all act post-embryonically. There are none that act embryonically. And in all cases, I think you would say that they are converting one differentiated cell to a kind of another differentiated cell. But they don't, the heterochronic genes aren't really in any obvious way involved in conversion of multipotentiality that I know of. Right. Okay, so let me just summarize some of the stuff I've said. So I presented evidence that there is a gene regulatory network, a cascade, a network. Maybe at least parts of it are pan-bilaterian, okay? And so we need more information about that, but it's coming together. I think we'll have more information about that very soon. I showed you that there seems to be remarkable plasticity in developmental modes. And one of the reasons that animals have been misplaced on evolutionary trees, and the molecular phylogenists then blew a lot of this away, is that people made conclusions based on morphology or based on developmental patterns. That works to an extent, but it breaks down, obviously. And I showed you these dramatically different modes of gastrulation, mosaic versus regulative modes. They're all in nematodes, for example. So there can be these big jumps in radically different modes of development in relatively short time spans, I think. So we have to be really careful in making any phylogenetic associations based on patterns of embryogenesis, for example. And that was used as a strong argument before molecular phylogeny came in. Also, sort of in an evolutionary context, see, there seems to be substantial selection for redundancy of a lot of these components, and I argued that in these three nematode trees, they're building this redundancy over and over and over. And let's see, it discussed how there is a single mechanism that seems to act reiteratively to make cells different from one another in asymmetric cell divisions, and those act combinatorially with these gene regulatory cascades. And then talked about our preliminary work on this conversion from pluripotency to commitment, and the surprising result we got that both cell intrinsic mechanisms, cell transcription factors and gene regulatory networks, and possibly cell-cell communication are involved in this switch. So let me stop there. And I guess thank some early collaborators, Tetsunori Fukushige and Jim McGee, and the Erringer lab for making this wonderful RNAi library. And then the people involved in the stuff I talked about are shown in red here, past members and current members of the lab involved in this, and I think I'll stop there. Thanks a lot.
More questions?
Okay. People are getting hungry.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.